Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What the fuckeristas? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. If you're new to the podcast, we've been at it since 2009, creating an interesting conversation all over the map for over a decade, well over a decade. We're doing this a long time. Thank you for listening. How are you? Look, today on the show, here's the deal. We get pitched guests from a booking agent, and Hunter Biden was pitched. He's got a book out, Beautiful Things, a memoir. It's out tomorrow. So I talked to my producer, Brendan McDonald. He says, what do you think of Hunter Biden? I'm like, I don't know. Do we need to get into that? Do we need to get tossed around by the cultural tsunami that follows that guy? And what is that guy really? And who is he? And I have no sense of him. And so I was like, nah, we don't need it. You know, he'll be all right without doing our show. And I don't know. I just don't know. It doesn't feel good. And then it started bothering me. Like I judge this guy based on what? Based on nothing. I've never seen him. I've never heard him talk. I know he had a drug problem. I know that the right wing machine sought to destroy him or destroy his father through him, that he had this horrendous drug problem. And I just assumed that he was like a sociopathic douchebag. You know, that was my, that's what I got in my head. But then it started to bother me. I was like, this Hunter Biden thing, you know, it was just sort of eating at me. I'm like, look, man, I'm a recovering guy. I don't really know what this guy's story is. And then I started thinking about, like, what has it got to be like to be trying to recover when you're being used as some sort of whipping boy by the right, by all the right-wing press, being judged by the right and left, but they're seeing you as some sort of portal into some nefarious conspiracy, and they're hammering and hammering and hammering. How does a human, let alone a drug addict trying to stay clean, deal with that? So, you know, I started thinking about, like, what is it like to be this guy? How did he handle it? This crack-addicted son of our current president. And look, I started to think, I know how to talk to these guys. If he's got a little sobriety, I know how to talk that. I know how to talk to drug addicts. I've met these guys before. I know low-bottom addicts who've dug out. I just started to think, like, well, get me the book. You know, and I read the book, and it just, I'll tell you, man, it's just most people probably have no idea, really, thankfully, what it's like to be in deep addiction, like to really not have any control over it, but to feel that need to do that stuff, that you no longer are concerned about yourself, the depth of self-destruction and depravity. I stayed in that groove. I'm like, well, let's see who this guy is. Let me reach out to this Hunter Biden as a sober guy and have this conversation. Let's do it. At the bottom of all this, it's like I like to have conversations with people about who they are, what they come from, what they do, what they want, how they got to where they are. You know what I do here. And I just knew that, you know, out of the gate, this was going to be, just from doing a little research before I read the book, I knew that he was a total mess with the marriages and the relationship with his brother's widow, all the accusations of him using, like he clearly traded on his family name to help with jobs. I didn't think he committed any crimes in doing that, but it seems pretty obvious that he did use his name for personal gain, though I assume that it's hard to know. I mean, he is a Yale-educated lawyer, but he is a Biden. But I imagine that gets a little blurry. But it was because of this that he was an easy target of people looking to hurt Joe Biden, to hurt Joe Biden's political prospects. He was the easiest target, in fact. Hunter was. And if you look into it, which I did, a lot of the stuff the right wing tried to use against him was transparently just an attempt to hurt his father. Nothing else. They basically tried to run the crooked Hillary playbook on Joe Biden by turning Hunter's business dealings into this financial conspiracy that involved Joe Biden and dubious corrupt forces in the Ukraine. And, you know, it was such a flimsy case that Trump got impeached by trying to manufacture it. And a lot of the accusations against Hunter were just tabloid fodder that attacked his character for being a drug addict. Like all that shit with his laptop. I mean, who the fuck cares about his laptop? Even the people who said they looked at this stuff on the laptop couldn't come up with anything. The guy had an insanely dark struggle with drugs, but he did survive that. And he has, to this point, survived this onslaught of political contempt. But he's not out of the woods in any real way. I mean, he has a reprieve, as we call it, in the recovery racket around that stuff. And if he does the work, you know, he can stay sober. But I mean, the Justice Department currently is looking into his taxes. There's an investigation that could end up with him in prison. You know, there's still a lot of struggle on the horizon for this guy. So I just want to I want to make that clear, because that was my sense. You know, outside of all of the made up shit, there's some very tangible, very real problems. And my intention in this conversation is not to clear his name or set anything straight for the right wing attack machine. It's not what we're doing here. So that's the kind of stuff I was thinking about going into this. So I read Hunter's book, and it's very clear who this guy is. And I don't think I'd realized just how deep into addiction he was, and just how recently. He only got a couple years clean. And I got to be honest with you, at the end of the book, like, you know, sometimes when you read these books, it's sort of like, well, that's, you know, he's got a little hindsight, and that was an uplifting story. I'm glad he kicked it, and he's, you know, and I learned a lot from it. But at the end of this book, I got to be honest, I was still concerned about this guy. I still wasn't sure that he was okay. And I brought that into the conversation. And I really didn't know what to expect, because I had not seen him talk. I did, you know, I've met a lot of drug addicts in my journey in sobriety and also in using. You know, I made assumptions about this guy's character, as I said at the beginning. I didn't know if he would be sort of a, you know, like a, if he was going to work me, if he was going to hustle me, if he was going to charm me, if he wasn't going to be candid with me, if he was a sociopath. I didn't know what. Is he a good guy? That seemed like a long shot. And right when he got here, you know, I asked him if he wanted coffee, because we all want coffee, all of us addicts. You just say, you want coffee? Yeah, of course I want coffee. I always want coffee. What are you taking it? Two sugars. No milk, sugars. I do it black. But this guy, as I said, he's only a couple years out of it. Gonna have a couple sugars in that coffee. You know, he's definitely been humbled. I don't think he's got another life in him. I think he's used them all up. I do feel, after talking to him, a bit concerned about his sobriety and his well-being, oddly. because I don't know him, but that's just the nature of what we do as recovering people. But I found him to be a very sensitive guy, very raw and open. His new book is called Beautiful Things, a memoir. It releases tomorrow. You can get it wherever you get your books. And it's an incredible document about, more than anything else, grief and the effects of grief in life, and then just addiction. It's out tomorrow. You can get it wherever you get books. This is me talking to Hunter Biden. Well, it's good to see you, man.
Yeah, thank you.
I read the book, and I got to be honest with you, as a guy who's done a share of drugs, at the point where you say, I got to take a break.
Yeah.
Okay. You're like, I got to take a break because I'm about to, it's triggering too much.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were a pretty legendary crackhead, man.
Oh, God. I swear to God. I shouldn't be here.
No, it's crazy, you know, because I mean, I'm coming up on, I guess this is my 22nd year.
Yeah, yeah. I listen to you all the time.
So oh, you
I
do? Got,
yeah, exactly.
Oh, so you know what the story is? Yeah. Well, how are you doing it? Do you feel like you're out of the woods? How are you doing? Are you doing it the thing? Are you doing the regular way, secret meetings?
No, well, I have been, you know, we have a mutual acquaintance. You know Moby?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What about, he's helping you out?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's like a whole crowd of people here.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a friend of a friend, and he just showed up at the house before COVID and was like, hey, man.
Yeah.
You know, you need someone to talk to. You need someone to take you to a meeting. I'm here.
Yeah.
And,
you
know, I first got clean and sober in 2003. And
that was the first, that was, yeah. It goes back that far.
Yeah. So, and you know, I mean, I ran big book meetings. I literally 3 hours every Sunday. I never missed a meeting in probably like 5 years. I mean, I was serious about it.
And what led up to that one? It's like the one thing I have a hard time putting together in the book is like the timeline, the cash, and the bouncing around, like, you know, where it got bad, when it got bad.
Yeah.
Because I know when I was using that what becomes very tangible is that you're going to become untethered from a moral compass or the reality that you once knew, that there's a line where you're like, if I cross that line, then I'm you know, there's no safety. It's all going to be gambler's luck after this.
Yep. Yeah.
And it's sort of a commitment to a life. And you're pretty clear about that. You're like, at some point you're
at
like,
the end.
Yeah. I'm this guy. There's no getting better.
That's it. Yeah.
That's like a horrendously terrifying.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of like, in retrospect, it reminded me a little of leaving Las Vegas. Like, you can't seem to succeed in killing yourself, but you no longer care if you do or not.
That was exactly it. I mean, it was almost as if that movie was playing right in front of my eyes.
Right.
It wasn't a concerted effort to go out and jump off a bridge.
Right.
But I might as well have gone out and jumped off a bridge. It was a much, you know, slower way.
Yeah.
But, you know, I first got sober in 2003. It was drinking. And
How old were you, man? In
2003, I was 33.
33?
Yeah, 33. Got sober, stayed sober for just close to 8 years.
Oh, so you had some real time.
I got my sobriety date was the day Johnny Cash died.
Uh-huh.
And I went to rehab, picked up the 12 steps.
Yeah.
Was very, you know, and it saved my life. And I mean, absolutely 100% saved my life. And by the way, it didn't only save my life then, it saved my life this time. Being able to have some of those tools at the outset, I stayed sober through the program.
The first go.
Yeah. But I had this counselor in my first rehab.
Yeah.
And he told me a story. He got sober. He got really into the program.
Yeah.
He became kind of a speaker.
Yeah.
And was flying all over the country.
Sure.
He became a
big time.
Big time. He was a counselor.
Yeah.
And he was on a plane.
Yeah.
And seven years sober. He's on a plane back from some speaking engagement on, you know, the sober life.
Right.
He got on the plane and he said like 4 days later, he woke up in, you know, in a different fucking city. And 7 years.
Yeah.
So 7 years in, I'm on a plane.
Yeah.
by myself.
Right.
No one else around. The flight attendant rolls up with the cart.
Yeah.
And says, hey, you know, would you like a drink?
Yeah.
And I said, I'll have a Bloody Mary.
Just like it was another day.
It was another day.
Yeah.
That started this, because relapse is so goddamn insidious.
Well, yeah, you know, and once you've had, like, if you got 7 years of program, then you got to drown that out. And you got to drown out whatever the
awful.
Fuck else.
And then you're lying to everybody, and you think nobody can tell you're drinking. So then I went back to rehab, and then I relapsed again.
But
what was
that? You know, I don't know how many people know the full story of the sort of ongoing tragedy of your family. Yeah. How old were you when your mother was killed?
I was just about 3.
So it's you in the car with Beau, your brother, and your two sisters?
No, my one sister.
The one sister, who was younger than you.
Yeah.
And your mother.
Yep. And she was about a year and a half younger. Beau and I are a year and a day apart.
Yeah.
February 3rd and 4th. Yeah. And then Naomi Christina, which we called Caspi. Caspi was in the car. And we were out buying a Christmas tree. It was right after my dad got elected in 1972. He was 29 years old.
To the Senate.
Yeah, to the Senate. And we got broadsided by a tractor trailer. And we both spent a lot of time in the hospital together. But my mom and my sister died in the accident.
Yeah.
And I never, in the program.
Yeah.
A lot of guys still say, like, you're an alcoholic because you're a goddamn alcoholic.
Sure.
You're an addict because you're an addict. It doesn't have anything to do with anything else.
Mm.
And I kind of adopted that because I felt really guilty about the idea of seeing anything as trauma,
Yeah.
Because so much of my life was, I had an incredible life growing up as a kid. You know, I mean, we remarried my mom.
Jill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I was 7, 8 years old. And, you know, but I had my aunts and my uncles. We were raised by my whole family.
Did you ever do any EMDR or anything like that?
No, I haven't. I did a little bit of it.
Yeah.
A little bit of it. And I've done...
I
have been a goddamn professional. I've done everything from, ayahuasca to ibogaine to 5-MeO.
Yeah, I read about that. Some old school shit. And I just wonder, like, do you, because there's some element to, like, and I'll be honest, like, I'm reading the book and you're talking about, growing up in the Senate, you and Beau, and the loss of Beau, which we'll talk about. But, when you start talking about crack, like, all of a sudden it's like you're in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's an immediacy to the writing. There's a passion to it.
Yeah.
Because there's something ever present. Like, when you think about crack or you do crack or drugs or whatever your thing was, you're not. It's different than nostalgia because that was a guaranteed thing, man. I mean, it's like the way you describe it is like you could always count on crack.
Yeah.
know what I mean? Like if you got the good shit.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the stuff trying to sort of frame the darkness of your life. And I never felt that you were saying that you were drinking or using drugs because of that. I just felt that you drank and you used drugs because you drank and you used drugs.
Yeah.
But I guess my question is, do you ever feel, like really feel, and not just like speculate, that the traumatic loss of your mother created, a tangible void?
100%. Is it? Have you ever watched? Have you seen the Dr. Gabor Mate? Have you watched?
Yeah,
him?
Yeah, I've read his stuff.
Like TED Talk, and
I haven't. I've read about half of his book.
Yeah. And as the first person I saw that explained it, that spoke to me about trauma being like the center of all addiction.
Really,
and it made me open my eyes to the idea that, there's a lot more work than just, which this isn't obvious, than just abstinence. I mean, I had all the tools of the 12 steps, which
right.
I think are, at least saved my life a number of times. But the work that I hadn't done, which by the way, part of this book was doing that work.
Yeah.
It was literally going through in talking about those things,
yeah,
talking about the accident and talking about losing Bo. And I am absolutely certain now is that you know, like I talk about that, you know,
yeah,
talk about it when we're in the rooms, that God-sized hole that you're trying to fill.
Sure.
And that to me is that trauma is it's not the excuse, it's not the reason, but it's certainly the thing that I think I'm trying to figure out.
Well, that sense of there one day, gone the next, and the brutality of the accident, and then just sort of that, you know, like a lot of, like I imagine that your sense of like need had to be intensified throughout your life. I mean, if I felt that in the way you talked about your brother and
yeah,
the sort of the relationship there, that that you do seem to rely on people a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, and that relationship, the when I lost Bo, I mean, I think I definitely convinced myself my whole life that the one thing that I couldn't possibly lose was my brother.
Yeah.
Is that I just couldn't be without him.
Yeah.
Is that, and I would say to people when he died, it literally felt like I lost like half my vocabulary. I didn't know how to talk to people. I felt... Like half a person for real, and I didn't.
This was just like 5 years ago, six years ago.
Yeah.
So you're in your 40s.
Yeah. Yeah. 45. Yeah.
And when you guys were growing up with because I have to assume, obviously, your father, like once I guess when he met Jill, that probably leveled him off a bit, right?
Yeah, but all of us. I mean, I think out of courtesy, like say my stepmom or my, you know, but
right,
she's my mom.
Right.
And we reformed a family and we had a great family. And
yeah,
I mean, my family is incredibly close. I mean, when my mom died, my uncles, Frankie and Jimmy moved into the, made the garage.
They still
into
around?
An apartment. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my uncle Jimmy's my best friend in the world.
Yeah.
I mean,
is your dad's brothers?
Yeah. My dad's brothers. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean,
are you guys an Irish clan?
Yeah, we are. Yeah. Very much so. Except my mother, who's Sicilian.
Uh-huh.
She makes everybody remember it all the time. But
yeah.
But and my grandparents, I mean, I saw my grandparents every day. I slept over at my grandparents' house. We called them Mom and Dad on my dad's side every, 3 days a week until I graduated high school.
Really?
Yeah.
And everybody was in Delaware? Yeah.
Everybody was in Delaware.
An hour? Of what?
Everybody was in literally 12 minutes of each other.
That's like, yeah, I remember that with my grandparents. Like, everybody was in New Jersey. They were within, 45 minutes away.
Yeah.
When somebody made dinner, everybody would show up for dinner.
Yeah. I mean, we that has always been us. And when Bo died, I think it was unimaginable for any of us. Bo and I had become such a center of the story of my whole family.
Well, how did that start? Like, you guys, obviously, after your biological mom was killed, that, what do you think it was about Bo's, fortitude around it to handle it and sort of like, somehow look out for you the way he did? You're only a year apart, but there seems to be a difference in disposition.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's a question. I haven't spent much time thinking about the ways in which Bo and I were different.
Right.
Because I never saw a separation between us. Now, we were really different. And look, my brother was no saint, but he was about as close to it as you get.
Uh-huh.
I mean, really. I mean, we called him the sheriff.
Yeah.
Literally. I mean, all his friends. And I mean, he was the guy that literally would walk into a party and said, okay, you stop drinking.
Yeah.
That person would stop drinking.
Right.
And he was never and he was funny as shit.
Yeah.
I mean, he had the greatest sense of humor. And it was just a choice that he made. And I made the choice to drink.
Mm.
And,
he drank. He just didn't drink.
Oh, no, he literally didn't have a drink until he was 21. So never through high school, and and not until he was a senior. And then he drank for socially.
And your old man, he doesn't drink at all, right?
He didn't drink at all either.
Why is that?
Yeah, I think because that I think he saw other people that we were that were close to, or their family.
You got family? Is it in there?
Yeah, I mean, we come from a big Irish family. Yeah, a bunch of Finnegans. And I've actually, the Finnegans, I've now learned that, were incredible incredible.
That's your dad's mom?
My dad's mom, yeah. Catherine Eugenia Finnegan, who is the source of all good in our family. Uh-huh. And, but my on my grandfather's side, you know, Joe Biden Sr., you know, there's a lot of alcoholism, and I think it's, and my dad, I think, saw that. I don't know exactly why I chose not to.
But your grandfather, Joe Biden Sr., was alcoholic.
No, he was not an alcoholic. Oh. But I think his uncles and you know, I mean,
So
a lot of people died young of things that we're not really sure of.
So right. So you think your old man saw that and just said, "I'm not going to do it."
Yeah,
not going to do it.
Exactly. And I think that Bo, you know, got that same message. You know, I don't know how people. And it's just like, I don't know. I mean, the first time I drank, all I knew is that, you know, I was 4'11". I weighed 90 pounds. I was a freshman in high school. And I asked the, you know, the 5'8" senior girl to the prom. Now, she laughed at me.
Yeah.
But I got up the nerve at the party to go ask her to the prom.
From drinking.
Yeah, from drinking. You know what I mean? In that moment, I was both embarrassed but really proud of myself.
Yeah.
And, you know, I felt like, for a moment, you know, that moment when all was right in the world.
Yeah.
And then you chase that, literally. You know, I found the most insidious drug I ever used was alcohol.
Yeah.
I mean, by far. I mean, it's the only drug that, could, you know, you could die from, you know, withdrawing from. It's the only drug.
But also, you can kind of do it around regular people.
Exactly. And it's literally, and it's hard to avoid it.
Yeah.
But the thing that grabbed me in a way that nothing else ever had was crack.
Yeah. when you're growing up, though, like, I'm just curious as to, because, you know, you spent a lot of time, you're like, in some ways, because, you know, your father's the president now, and he was the vice president for 8 years. But in some ways, I have to assume that from a very young age, when you grow up in politics, in, you know, your dad's a senator, he's a popular senator, everybody knows him. He, you know, he's well respected in the state. That, like, on some level, there's this idea, like, you know, when you start getting targeted by the right and everything else, that there's some part of you that, because I know you know that you're the son of the president, and I know that you know you were the son of the candidate who was going to be president and the vice president. But on another level, I mean, there's the weight to that. But you also, I think, when you grow up like you did, that president is just the biggest promotion you can get.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know what president is, but you're around presidents. Yeah. You're around senators. You're around government. So it doesn't register quite the same way. Or am I wrong?
No, to a certain degree, you are. I mean, that's
right.
What
right or wrong.
You're right.
Oh.
That it doesn't register until it happens.
Right.
And because it's exponentially different. I mean, exponentially
when they
different.
Become vice president?
When they become vice president, from senator to vice president, exponentially different, and then become president, exponentially different. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we grew up in Delaware.
Right.
My dad commuted every day.
Yeah.
And
on the Amtrak.
Yeah, on the Amtrak, of which I was on the board of the Amtrak. But he commuted every day.
Your first gig? Was that your first gig?
No, no, I was 10 years into being a lawyer. And I, you know, I mean, this is one of the other things. I've served on well over a dozen boards.
Yeah.
I mean, I was chairman of the board of the World Food Program U.S., which is, you know, supports the U.N. World Food Program, which just won the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, it's the largest humanitarian organization. I served on, like, beyond a healthy number of boards, and most of them all nonprofits.
So he's going to the
anyway.
He's commuting to work.
He's commuting to work.
Yeah.
And in Delaware, like, you know, when Bo and I would be, you know, when we were like 16, 17 years old, and you get pulled over for speeding. It wasn't like, you know, there was no trepidation on the part of the Delaware State Police officer to literally walk up to the car and, like, look down and say, "Oh, your dad is going to kill you." You know,
right?
Wait till I tell Joe. I'm going to see him down at the train station. And, you know, he was Joe.
And Delaware is small. So
Delaware is small. Yeah, I mean, 750,000 people. It's like growing up in a town. And, you know, everybody knew us, mainly because of the tragedy, but it's so small. And we were always with my dad, by choice, always with my dad.
Like, you'd go up to the Capitol, hang out.
Well, I mean, we'd go down to D.C., but literally get off the train, go to his office as kids, you know, run around the Russell Building, and then, you know, ride the subway cars between that and the Capitol, and, you know, and then get back on the train with him and go home.
Right. So it's like your playground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we never lived in D.C.
Yeah.
And so I didn't grow up knowing any other, you know, senators' kids. I didn't, you know, and, you know, my dad was listed as the, you know, the 535th poorest person in Congress. Yeah. You know what I mean? And, it, you know, I think he left the Senate with less assets than anyone in the history of the body.
It strikes me that, you know, he's like a real civil servant. I mean,
100%. You know, all of those the qualities that I think the good qualities that people see in my dad, it's not only not, I mean, it's real beyond even that. You know, I mean,
and that, is that a lot of, was that a lot of pressure for you? I mean,
which part? Well, I mean, which stage? As a kid growing up?
Well,
no.
Just right. You just looked up to him.
Yeah,
but at some point when you started to realize your expectations out of yourself and perhaps what you thought your father's expectations were. I mean, when did it start to weigh on you that you had a sort of like you didn't know what to do and you felt compelled to follow in the footsteps of your father? And it seems like your brother was a little more focused on politics.
Yeah. And he took a lot of that. I don't think either of us felt pressure. I always felt for children of people that are in powerful positions.
Yeah.
And you can see if they don't have that relationship with the dad like Bo and I had with my dad.
Right.
It must be such a burden.
Yeah.
I didn't ever view it that way. Bo was more certain that he wanted to go into politics. You know? I mean, yeah. I grew up wanting to write and paint. You know? I mean, that's what I wanted to do.
What, did you do that when you were a kid?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah? I mean, and like in high school, like what were you like in high school? I mean, aside from getting drunk, did you hang out with the freaks and the artists?
Both. I mean, I played football and I, you know, but I hung out with the guys in the smoking pit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When they still had smoking pits.
I remember. Yeah, they had to.
Yeah exactly.
I remember like in my school, you could smoke everywhere.
Yeah.
But in high school, I'm a little older than you. I was able to move through. I was never a jock of any kind, but I definitely was able to talk to everybody, freaks, jocks.
Yeah, 100%. And that was I know when I applied to law school, I also applied to the writing program at Syracuse.
Where'd you go to undergrad?
I went to Georgetown.
Oh, right. That's right. You were at Georgetown.
Yeah.
And so like...
I went to Georgetown. I graduated Georgetown and I went and did a thing called the Jesuit Volunteer Corps.
Where was that?
It's like a domestic peace corps.
Uh-huh.
I did it out in Portland, Oregon. My original posting was going to be to a Native American reservation in Eastern Washington State, but the volunteers that were there decided to stay. So this Jesuit priest I knew said, I'm from Portland. Portland's really cool. So I went to Portland.
We got a problem with the hipsters coming in.
Yeah.
We need you to.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, that was just at the beginning.
I know.
That was like 1990. 92, 93.
Well, I mean, now, see, that's an interesting question. Like, so, like, how do you know to do something like that? I mean, you know, you graduate Georgetown, you're probably drinking pretty hard, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I drank, but I also did well. And, you know, I spent a lot of time doing things that, you know, I was, you know, worked for the Center for Immigration Policy and Refugee Assistance. I started a program.
But how does that happen? Like, well, how do you think
you know
to
how
do
it
those
happened
things?
For me? I mean, well, number one, because that's what I wanted to do. I knew when I went into college, the only thing that I was certain I wanted to do was go to the Peace Corps. That's what I wanted to do.
To help people or to travel?
To help people. Yeah, I didn't think I'd be traveling to places that most people wanted to. And then there was this really cool Jesuit priest, Ted Dziak, that when you go to Georgetown, there's a Jesuit priest lives on every floor. And you know, I tell you the truth, I mean, we'd go and I'd drink Bushmills. And he had started a thing called the Jesuit International Volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in Micronesia and in Nepal and a couple other places. And he asked me if I wanted to help him start a summer program. And so I did that. And we went to Belize and we started the summer program for kids in Dangriga, Belize. And he talked me out of doing Peace Corps. He said, if you want to do something for people, there's a hell of a lot of people here at home that you need to do that could use the help.
Now, is this a message of the Jesuit school, or was it just because you grew up in a family that was doing service?
Both. I knew what I wanted to do, and I ended up in the Jesuit Volunteer Corps, which is non-ecumenical. You don't have to be Catholic to be a part of it. You live with other volunteers. At the time, you made $80 a month. You lived in a house. You pulled your money for food, and, you know, that was it, you know, in 1992. I don't know what the monthly stipend is now.
But right.
the idea was service. And right. And so I worked in the basement of a church that I sat in a little office and
yeah.
and people would pick up the phone from the neighborhood that didn't have groceries
right.
or they couldn't get their lights turned on, and yeah. I'd advocate for them.
But you also wanted to write and yeah. and express yourself and be a painter, and
yeah.
and so you took a year in the there.
Yeah, I did that, and you
applied to the graduate school.
Yeah, exactly. And I applied to my brother was at Syracuse at that time, and at Syracuse
in the law school.
Yeah, law school. And so I applied there, and I applied
for law.
Yeah, for law.
Uh huh.
And but they had a great writing program that at the time Raymond Carver was there.
Raymond Carver.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then Tobias Wolff was there. Raymond Carver died, I think, before I applied. But
are you a big Raymond Carver fan?
Yeah, I was really.
Yeah,
big
it seems like, you know, like yeah. your entire life are chapters in a Raymond Carver.
Yeah.
but there seems yeah. to, at this point there's a yeah. you're in the middle of a relatively yeah. happy ending.
It's,
so
it's between a Raymond Carver and a Stephen King short story, to tell you the truth. But the so I applied there and to do a dual degree in
creative writing program. Law?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. But you know, I had thought about applying to the Iowa Writers Program and
oh, that's a big
and,
one.
And but then I got married and was with a baby on the way.
How'd you meet her?
At the Jesuit that's, Volunteer Corps.
That's yeah. Kathleen?
Yep. Yep.
And you met her in Portland.
Yep.
And you just started dating, and you know yeah. you weren't out of control in any way yet.
No.
You're just a normal.
I was a normal
20-something
yeah.
year old.
Yeah, 23 year old
kid hanging out in Portland.
Yeah, a lot of time at Powell's Books, drinking. You know,
yeah,
a bottomless cup of coffee.
Yeah, thinking.
Yeah, thinking. Doing a lot of thinking.
Doing the reading.
Yeah, exactly. Doing a lot of thinking. Worried about the Jesuit priest down in El Salvador, and you know what I mean. Like,
right,
you
sure.
know what I mean, a lot of that.
So. Yeah. Now, do you got married because she was pregnant, or?
Yeah, but we were in love.
Yeah,
we were in love.
Yeah,
and Naomi, my daughter, was born in December of 1993, and I decided though to you know that being up in Syracuse was in the winterland of Syracuse,
sure.
rather than closer to home,
right?
Which I decided to go to Georgetown and go to law school.
So you went to law school at
I did my first year at Georgetown, and then I transferred to Yale.
So you're saying to me that the primary incentive was to provide for the family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I don't regret any of it. You know, I mean, I don't regret any of it. That part of my life, a beautiful part of my life, and we spent 2 years in New Haven. I graduated from Yale. Because I just didn't get in when I first got there.
Where'd you go? Did you eat Sally's Pizza or the other one?
Sally's.
You went to
yeah, Sally's. Actually, you know what the coolest thing was?
What?
Is that we had a little baby.
Yeah.
And I looked, if you see a picture of me from there,
yeah.
I was 23, but I looked maybe 16 years old.
Yeah.
And so people would literally come up to us and say, you know, where are your parents? Like, you, like straighten that baby's head up in the stroller. You know, like, they shouldn't be leaving you, that kid with you.
Yeah.
But I literally was probably the only people ever that didn't have to wait in line at the Sally's. Not because of anything to do with my name.
Yeah.
But we would come and we'd have this little baby.
And you like, and you look like kids.
And there was Flo that worked up at the, uh-huh. yeah. I love Sally's.
Yeah, so yeah.
They made that. We lived right there.
Oh, yeah.
On Court Street. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I just got introduced to the whole scene, the whole New England pizza
okay,
scene
gotcha. Yeah.
when I played there not too long ago. And there's that other place that
Pepe's.
Makes... Pepe's. Is the other pizza.
Yeah.
What about that weird hamburger machine?
The first ever hamburger.
Yeah,
exactly.
That place.
I used to go there with my guy that is like an uncle to me, Roger, every Wednesday. He'd take me to... Don't ask for cheese.
Nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
You take it the way they give it.
On toast.
Yeah. It's a weird thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's a novelty item. And you're wondering, it's like, it's one of those things that's been there forever.
Yeah.
Like, there used to be a place in Harvard Square called The Tasty, which was on the corner. It was just this little counter.
Yeah.
Food was okay. But it's a novelty of it. And you're probably half shit-faced when you're eating that hamburger, usually, anyways.
Yeah. I'm sure we're interested in a lot of people in our talk of Yale and Harvard.
Sure. We're talking hamburgers.
Yeah, hamburgers.
We're talking about hamburgers and pizza.
Yeah,
there's no elitism in hamburgers and pizza.
No,
it's just the location of the two places.
Yeah.
All right, so now you're a family man, and you're doing what you got to do to get into the world where you can support your family.
Yeah.
You let go of the Raymond Carver dreams.
Yeah.
The sitting at the coffee shop, writing, thinking.
Exactly.
And now you're about to enter the game.
Yeah.
And how does that go? So you graduate the law degree?
I graduate with a law degree.
Now, how's the booze at this point? When do you graduate?
1996.
Okay.
From law school. And
Two kids by then?
No, one.
Just a one.
Yep. And then make a decision of, you know, whether to go work for a big law firm.
Yeah.
Because I paid for my law school.
And right.
I paid for my college, too. And figuring out how to be able to handle the loans and then, I'd worked at the summers at some big law firms. I worked at, I got offers from Skadden Arps and, you know, like, anyway.
Now, are you feeling at this point, it's still pretty early, but I mean, do you feel at this point that your name is getting you anywhere?
Well, it's really hard to, like, separate the two. But
sure.
But I know this, is that I could have gotten, I was at Yale Law School.
No, I know. Yeah.
And so, I mean, like, I wasn't,
And
wasn't.
You did all right.
What?
You did all right.
I did real well.
Yeah.
And I was, I'm proud of that.
Yeah.
I mean, worked my ass off. Because one of the things is that, I'll tell you what, I don't care what your name is. Say you're, whether it's acting or anything.
Yeah.
Is it, your name can be, whatever.
Yeah.
If you show up and you're Tom Cruise's kid and, you may get the first movie, but you're not getting the next 10.
That is true.
And by the way, I mean, I don't know of any profession in the world in which, it's like, I don't know many dentists that their dad wasn't a dentist.
Well, right.
If you're a shitty dentist, you don't last very long.
That's right.
Very long.
But I think at some point, when your life started to get away from you and the nut became too big for you to manage.
Yeah.
That I think you did learn as your father grew in stature that the name did offer you some cachet.
Yeah. But to your point, figuring out how to filter that is one thing when your dad's a United States Senator.
Right.
Figuring out how to filter that is another thing when he's a whole nother thing when he's vice president.
And when you've got a habit.
Yeah.
So when you do land a job, where's that first gig as a lawyer?
I went to work for a bank, MBNA, which is the largest credit card bank in America at the time. And I went to work as a lawyer.
Oh, and
I couldn't take it.
But you took some shit for that from the right.
Oh, I mean, Michelle Malkin wrote an entire book about how my dad was, bought off by the credit card companies. Now, they were the banks at the time, the largest employers in the state of Delaware. And, but regardless, I went back and a lot of really good people. I mean, I only lasted for about a year and a half there.
Because it was just too much or?
No, because it was like, I mean, I went from, thinking that I was going to, write novels and paint maybe work as a public defender.
Yeah.
To go in directly into working for a credit card bank.
Doing what?
I was a lawyer.
What does
contracts.
The job? Oh.
Yeah, I mean the contracts. They were affinity marketing.
Immediately soul deadening is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. Again, I got to make it clear because Delaware's a small place. I love the people that were there. I mean, really good people, but it wasn't for me. I mean, wearing my MBNA pin and, my blue suit with the white shirt and the specific tie on a daily basis. And so I left and I went to work for the, I went down to Washington and got a job with the Clinton administration and thinking again, along the lines of public service.
What were you doing for them?
I ended up working for Bill Daley at the Department of Commerce, and I was the longest title in government, I think.
Yeah.
I was the Executive Director of e-commerce Policy Coordination for the Office of the Secretary. That's what my card actually said.
Wow. So
when they called it e-commerce.
Two-sided card. You had to flip it over.
Exactly.
So when does it start to get away from you? When do you have that second kid?
Right before I took that job, we had Finnegan.
Yeah.
And
the second kid.
Yeah, Finny. Her name is Finnegan. Finnegan James.
Finnegan and Naomi.
Yeah, then my third is Maisie.
Yeah.
And but I have the second, and administration ends, and we're all waiting for the next administration, which is going to be the Gore administration.
Right.
That doesn't happen.
There's a numbers issue.
Yeah, a numbers issue.
Yeah.
And I had to figure out what I was going to do, and I decided what I was going to do because I had a bunch of buddies that were, you know, riding high on the dot-com bubble. And so what I did was I started my own law firm and to focus on that. And then
e-commerce.
Yeah, and then, you know, and then the bubble burst on that. So I had to figure something else out. And what I figured out was a friend from that was president of one of the Jesuit universities said he could use some help. We have a send teachers into this school in the toughest part of Philadelphia, and we're looking for help with federal funding. And I said I'd help them. And so then I created a law firm that was 90% of my business was representing Jesuit universities that were trying to get things like mobile dental clinics and, I mean, a whole host of...
So again, you know, service-oriented.
Service-oriented, but I was making money, and I was doing okay. And what happened
Catholic
was...
Catholic Church got some bread.
What?
They got some bread, the Catholic Church. A little bit of money.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, but the incredible thing about Jesuit universities, they're the only schools that are still like it's the only school still in inner city Detroit. And, you know, I mean, there's not a, at the time I was doing it, there was not a dentist office in the city limits of Detroit, except for Detroit University's, which is the Jesuit University's, Detroit Mercy's dental school.
Yeah.
And so we got mobile dental. Anyway, that's when my drinking started to be, to get out of control.
2000.
And because, you know, you're hanging out in D.C. and I decided to, I was going to try to do what my dad did, which is commute back to Delaware.
Yeah.
Because he could afford a house there rather than in D.C. And, you know, then I'd stay down a little bit longer and then I'd go to the, you know, go across the street to the Bombay Club and have, you know, 16 too many drinks. And,
yeah, just like, you know, it's like I remember, like I, you know, I remember, you know, that, like, it's been a long time for me, you know, and the obsession is gone. But, you know, getting into that routine where, you know, if you've got the one thing that I think a lot of people don't understand about drug addiction and alcoholism, if you don't know what it feels like to want that shit in the way that an addict wants it, you can't understand what the fuck we're talking about.
Exactly.
And, you know, exactly. And it's like a lot of people kind of like, you know, you had a little problem. It's like you don't get it.
Yeah.
Like where you just all day long, you just waiting for that drink.
Yeah.
Just to get out so you can walk across the street and sit in a fucking half empty joint and be like, I'm good. Yeah. I'm good now.
Yeah, exactly. I, you know, the best description I've ever, one of the best is I heard Mike Tyson talking about it.
Uh-huh.
And he said, have you ever been really hungry?
Yeah.
Well, think about it that you're starving.
Yeah.
That you haven't had food in 40 days.
Yeah.
And somebody, you know, and the cheeseburger's right over there.
Yeah.
That insatiable, like, feeling. I mean, there's no conscious thought that goes into it.
But it's like it's deep, man. It's weird. It's it feels like, you know, I'm going to get whole.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, that's the thing, too, is that, you know, and that's when I realized that I needed to get help, was then when it wasn't just a mental obsession.
Yeah.
When it became a physical obsession, when I wake up in the morning and I'd have to, you know, reach in under the bed for the, you know, the pint of Smirnoff that I hid just to be able to get into the shower. And so that's when I quit that first time. Yeah.
You're like low bottom shit, man.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you're drinking.
That was my high bottom.
Yeah, I know.
And I should have stuck right the fuck there. I should have stuck there. I had the chance, and everybody told me that I went to the, and that said, don't do it.
Yeah.
Like, I the guys that come back in and sit down and say, I just went out and I tested it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just got out of jail. Yeah. Or I just, you know, or, yeah, you know, yeah, I'm, yeah. I'm three divorces later.
Yeah. My liver's almost gone.
Yeah. Exactly. Or they're dead. And so many of them.
I know, man. I mean, there's people, it's like you mentioned Permanent Midnight in your book. Jerry's one of my good friends.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. He's like, and like that guy survived.
I can't, talk about triggering.
Yeah.
I can't do
it. Well, Jerry's a warrior. He's a survivor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And he's,
well, that's the other thing, Mark, too, is that, you know,
yeah.
is that I ain't alone.
No, I know.
Like, I'm not, like my story, it's not like, it's rough. And it seems rougher because of who my dad is. But the fact of the matter is that I mean, how many of me do you know?
It's just lived. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I definitely know many of you, yeah. but yeah. Like, you know, you guys are alive to tell the story. How many of you do I know that died?
Yeah.
Who the fuck knows? Yeah. I mean, it's like worse than it ever now.
Yeah.
So, all right, so you go to so you clean up in 2001?
2003.
So when do you, like, when did you join the service?
Yeah, you know, that was one of those decisions that you know, my brother had gone into the Army National Guard and had gone to Iraq, and but this was before he went to Iraq, and I'd always wanted to do it, but I didn't think I could, and I started the idea of doing it when I was sober.
Yeah,
and I unfortunately acted on the idea when I was not. And so
you joined, or you?
I joined.
Activated.
I mean, I wasn't. I mean, I was in that cycle where I was like, you know, I mean, that's one of the part of the things that people don't understand too, is you get, you know, at least back then, you get, you know, you get 60 days under your belt, and you think like, hey, what I should do is join the Navy at the age of 41.
Well, you're one of those guys with the big ideas, and you do it when you're fucked up. I know. I mean,
yeah, but I was sober. I mean, like, I was sober, but right. This is the first time since a long time I realized why they say don't make any decisions. Don't make any big decisions in that first year.
Yeah.
And
that don't get into a relationship. Don't make any big decisions.
Exactly.
Don't hang out with the fucking guys anymore.
Yeah, exactly. You
know? I immediately grabbed hold of a woman and I married her. I hung on to her for dear life. I married her, and then she left a drained husk 8 years later. it hated me. It still hates me.
Yeah, yeah.
That's sober.
Yeah, yeah. I know. And I, you know, I mean, thank God in this time is that I haven't made any of those decisions. You know, I mean, Melissa literally saved me, and in that moment,
your current wife.
Yeah, I knew that I was gonna, that God Almighty, I had to hang on.
Oh Jesus Christ! That. You got to be pretty beat up, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, after a certain point, I mean, I know you talk about, you know, being able to bullshit and lie and everything else, but you've got to be humbled.
Oh,
I mean,
in a way that it's pretty awesome. Well, humblingly.
Well, because like I read the book, like, and at the end, I'm like, oh, Jesus, I'm a little concerned.
Yeah. By the way, you're not the only one. You're not the only one.
I don't think.
But by the way,
I don't think he's out of the woods. This kid.
No. But by the way, then when the book ends, I'm clearly not out of the woods.
Okay.
That's when the hard work starts.
Okay.
Man. You know, I say that. I like say to everybody. I think I write it in the book.
Yeah.
Is that this is the truest thing I ever heard? Is that if getting sober is easy, all you got to do is change everything.
Right. Yeah.
And I can tell you that. The ability to change everything requires, at least for me, not only getting honest with the people around me, but getting honest with myself. And for the first time, I've been allowed to. I give myself permission to do that. Now, you know, it's a hell of a lot easier when your story's being, you know, the concocted story of you out there is even worse than the story that I write in the book.
Yeah,
but, you know.
But did you pick up your laptop?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the creepiest thing is that I have no clue what's real. Only thing I do know is that the intelligence community just came out with a report that said the entire thing is Russia's disinformation. And I just tell people, just give them my book.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all right there.
Well, no,
I got nothing to hide.
Right. The funny thing is like, you know, like given how much shit was stolen from you over the years when you were high.
Yeah.
Who the fuck knows?
Exactly. Who knows? The only thing I do know is that Rudy Giuliani's supposedly sleeping with it, which is creepy enough just to even think about it.
Well, I don't know how the hell, like, I mean, like, but like, I wanted to talk about the Navy Reserve.
Navy,
because, like, that seemed to be the turning point. Because you got, what happened? You got busted?
Yeah. Well, I was, you know, I did a drug test that I failed. I had no idea, truthfully, how I failed it because I knew that the drug test was coming. I still don't know.
What was it, blow?
It was cocaine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at this time, I was not smoking crack.
Yeah.
I was drinking heavily. But it was the most goddamn embarrassing thing that I've ever, At that point, it was.
Well, at this point, is like, is your brother concerned about you?
Yeah.
Is your father like, what are we going to do? Is are you?
No. There's never that. See, the thing with my family is, there's never like, you know, like a discussion behind my back. Like, what are we going to do about Hunter? It's like, you know. Where the fuck is Hunter?
I mean,
like, you know, my dad calls me every day. He called me every day through this whole period of time. If he doesn't get me on the phone, then he texts me 32 times. I mean, he literally, you know, there's...
Worried.
Yeah, I mean, worried, but he's always his whole life. You know, I think, you know, it's something that you learn when you lose people that you love is that, you know, if you get a chance to call your the people that you care about most, you do it. And it was, you know, and so my point is that there was never a feeling of like, oh my God, I let my dad down. All I knew is that I let myself down.
Yeah.
And that they were there to help pick me up.
It just seems like with not unlike many addicts that you start letting yourself down over and over again and you get used to it and then you just see yourself as a piece of shit.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you know, you can't get out from under it.
Yeah.
So this is the beginning of the end of the marriage though, right?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, Jesus Christ, divorce is so hard. And, you know, my girls, my daughters are so amazing. They love their mom and they love me like so much.
You getting along with her?
Yeah.
Now?
Yeah. It's okay.
Yeah.
You know, but it, like you said,
put it through
a lot. It's hard. Put it through a lot. A hell of a lot. And, you know, it's, I always say it's the courage to get sober is one thing. The courage to stick around somebody trying to get sober.
How many rehabs did you go through with her?
Let me see. At least six different, you know, at least six different programs.
And just like, it just wears them down.
Yeah, I mean, I did outpatient. I did. Yeah. And then you relapse and then you lie about it and then you fess up to it, but you keep drinking, you know, like, and then you have to think, oh my God. And then ultimatums are laid down because that's what they tell you need to do.
My first marriage, I don't got no kids, so it's different, but like, it just got to the point where it's like, I'm never going to, there's no way she's going to forgive me after a certain point. And I don't want to live in that.
Exactly.
That, you know, live in the contrition that will never be received.
Exactly. And it's not their fault.
No, you fucked it up.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the truth is that I'm not even 2 years clean yet. And so figuring all that out in my head is that I know I got a hell of a lot of amends to make to a lot of people.
You're doing the thing, though, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, here's, like, what I was trying to see. It's like, you know, now all of a sudden, you know, you get attention from the right wing over, you know, MBNA initially. But you're attached to your father. You're Joe Biden's kid. And now you're wrestling with, you know, massive alcoholism. And then, you know, once crack gets into the picture and, you know, you buy yourself, like, a huge house.
Yeah.
Well, in 2006, right?
Oh, no, I didn't. It wasn't a huge house, but it was expensive. Yeah, exactly.
My point being is that, like, you're nuts getting out of control.
Yeah, I, what I did was I sent three girls to private school, and I'm, you know, and I buy a house in, you know, Spring Valley, close to the school, and you want to be in Washington instead of, in Virginia, and I don't have any savings. And so it's literally, you know, what I'm making is going to, you know, paying for house tuitions for the vacation that you want to take for the, you know, I mean,
to live that life.
Life.
Right. So when did the international hustle start?
Not until after Bo got sick. And so.
So
2014.
So you were just doing, right. So the other gigs were like, you know, you started a hedge fund with your uncle and did something.
I tried to start a
And that didn't work out.
No, it didn't work out. I was sober then.
It just didn't work out.
You know, I mean, one thing is that you think that, you know, D.C. is bad. Go to Wall Street. I mean, it's just like, oh my God.
But you did some lobbying and you worked for Amtrak.
I did that. My core business was lobbying on behalf of the Jesuit universities.
Okay. Yeah. And then, like, once your dad becomes VP, you can't do that.
And I didn't work for Amtrak. You know, that was a non-paid
board
position. I mean, you don't get paid at all.
Right.
I mean, that was like, I was appointed by George Bush to do that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I guess the point is, like, again, when your dad becomes VP, it takes a shot at your business.
100%. And so I dropped because the Obama campaign had made Anna McCain campaign made such a big deal about lobbying and what they used to call earmarking and things. And so I completely changed my business, and I dropped all my lobbying clients so that wasn't an issue. I worked on behalf of a big engineering company and that, you know, just to do business, you know.
Where was that?
They were based out of Wichita, Kansas.
Oh, yeah.
But they do, I mean, they built, you know, roads and bridges and stadiums.
And what exactly do you do for these places?
For them?
Like as a,
what I was doing, I was a consultant for them. So I'd
go in.
What
does that mean?
Well, what it means is that if they wanted to go into the city of Baltimore for the new stadium,
right?
You know, I would help them. I would figure out with them, you know,
who the people are to talk to,
the regulatory environment, you know, because I was a lawyer too,
right.
And so, you know, who are the people to talk to? What are the regulatory hurdles?
But at this point, like, are you feeling
sober?
You're sober, but are you feeling desperate?
Well, I mean, I have to pay the bills,
and they're bad. They're big, right?
Yeah, but I wasn't desperate.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's 2008.
Yeah. Yeah,
I start that new business, and you know, I had a good, I built up a really good business.
Yeah,
and I was proud of that business.
And then when does it start to get? It seems that, you know, China and the Ukraine is the portal through which the right wing runs the big racket through you.
Yeah.
And like, it seems to me that you were so, like, you know, in need of money and bordering on being out of control.
Yeah.
That the idea that you could manage a conspiracy.
I mean, that's the most ridiculous thing. Is that, I mean, literally, it's so banal. I mean, as it relates to Ukraine, just take this. Is that the thing that drives me the craziest?
Yeah.
Is this idea that I never had a job,
right,
and that somebody like plucked me out of the, a target, and decided that this is the way that they're going to, you know, create a criminal empire or something.
Yeah.
You know, I was at least on 14 boards, or served on 14 boards in major positions. And in some of them, I was head of the corporate governance committee. I was a lawyer at that time. I was working for, I was of counsel to Boies Schiller and Flexner, which is one of the biggest law firms in the world.
What is the benefit of being on a board? Why so many
boards? Well, because it was all service oriented. So I did the World Food Program US. I was on the Center for National Policy. I was on a whole different bunch of boards. I was on, you know, JVC Northwest Advisory Board. I was on Catholic Charities.
Right.
I mean,
made
stuff
you
like
look
that.
Good. And you enjoyed doing it.
You know, I actually really enjoyed doing it.
Yeah.
And I didn't need to, I wasn't running for anything.
Yeah.
I wasn't. And, you know, I mean, look good to who? I mean, nobody was writing about the number of boards I was on.
No,
and
but
they still don't.
Maybe to yourself is what I mean.
Oh, it made me feel good.
Yeah.
100%.
Like, yeah, I mean, because, like, at some point, an active battle begins.
100%.
In between the dark you and the you that is of service.
The me that, that has to pay tuitions, and not just tuitions.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean,
life, alimony, you know, at some
life.
Point.
Yeah. I mean,
spousal support, child support.
Now, I mean, that's all comes later. But anyway, my point is that I didn't have any issue with going to work for a company that was under threat from an invading Russia.
Yeah,
of its entire existence, and they came to me as a lawyer at Boies Schiller, and to do
Burisma did.
Yeah, Burisma did,
because they wanted to legitimize their business
I think ultimately that's what it is, because they wanted to expand internationally, because they knew that they couldn't only depend upon Ukraine for their entirety of their business,
and they were once an appendage of Russia. I mean, that the Ukraine was
exactly.
It was an oligarchical structure.
Yeah,
and so this is post oligarchical structure.
Yeah,
and they want to, you know, broaden the business on an international level to give them some credibility and some freedom.
They kick out Yanukovych.
Yeah.
They have a democratic held election.
Yeah,
there's a whole bunch of reforms.
Yeah,
but then Putin invades their east coast.
Yeah.
Mainly for one thing, for their natural gas.
Yeah.
And so he takes over Crimea, and, you know, and so, you know, Burisma is an independent largest natural gas company in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And, you know, is feeling very threatened. And so it came to me as a lawyer to help them do a own internal security check to basically determine whether or not, you know, Kroll had done a report, which is one of those big international, you know, security and investigation firms. And I had them do another, a Nardella report.
That's Nick Kroll's dad, the comedian.
Oh, is it really?
I think so.
Seriously?
I think that,
Well, he's got it good. But anyway, long story short, I'd done both of those and come to the conclusion that they were, you know, they were, as things
on
go,
the level?
On the level, really on the level.
Yeah.
And there's a guy that was president of the, president of Poland, the first democratic, truly democratic president of Poland, a guy named Kwasniewski, who was on the board.
Yeah.
And he is a beacon of democracy.
Right.
He literally is, like, you know, one of the loudest voices against what's happening in Poland now. And he said, and he called me and he said, Hunter, would you join the board? To do what? And he said, well, number one, it's really important for us to be able to go outside of Ukraine.
Yeah.
And we need to show that we're different.
Right.
That we're different than this mess. The other one is to Putin, is to say, you know, we're choosing the other side.
Right.
And the third one is that I had an expertise in corporate governance. And
right.
I said, if my role was limited to that, that's what I would do. And I did the job, you know. Now, I did not take into consideration that this would be a flat-out Russian operation. To, you know, with all of these guys, I mean, supposedly directly from the desk of Vladimir Putin. I mean, that's what the
which
DNI
guy,
report.
Which operation?
To a disinformation
about
campaign,
you.
About me.
Right. That ultimately.
And so what they then did was what ended up, requiring an impeachment.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Which is try to muscle the government of the Ukraine to open an investigation into you and your father.
Yeah.
And it doesn't sound like your father was involved
at all. I mean, God almighty. I mean, not even by the way, no one has ever found that. Not once.
But he knows you're doing the job.
Yeah.
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 But
yeah.
Does he say things like, is it okay? Everything all right?
I did the press release when I joined the board.
Right.
And that was part of it. And he said, I hope you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And that's the only conversation we had on it. Because at that time, I really did know what I was doing.
Yeah.
I did not take into account.
And he wasn't going to run for president at that point.
And he wasn't going to run for president at the time. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I was a year away. Bo had been diagnosed.
Oh, really?
About 7 months before that.
Yeah.
And, you know, glioblastoma.
And that's not, that prognosis is just no good, huh?
It's,
and how's your drug use at that time?
It was nothing. I mean, I was clean and sober.
Mm.
Through then to when Bo dies.
Mm. And when were you working for BHR Partners?
That was a private equity firm.
Yeah.
And the idea was to create a private equity group to be able to invest outside of China into, U.S. infrastructure projects and things like that, which all shut down. I mean, again, it really kind of simple thing. I invested in it. I have never received a dollar from it, not a dime.
Well, I think the one part of the story that nobody really gets into is like, you make a lot of bread. You make a lot of money.
None. I mean, zero. I literally. And, you know, I mean, they have me like carrying a bag of, I mean, it's like, it becomes ridiculous.
Well, how did you not drink or use once that starts to happen? I mean, like, you know, once.
Well, that didn't start to happen until after Bo died.
It didn't?
No.
Oh, so that was leading up to 2016.
No. So remember, I.
So, right. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So 2015, and at the end of May, Bo passes away.
Yeah.
I stayed sober. I've been that whole, a little less than 2 years. I mean, I'm with my brother constantly.
Were you there you were there in the hospital every day?
Oh yeah. I mean, I never left. I went with him everywhere. And
it was a slow decline.
Yeah. And so, we tried everything, and we did everything. Thinking back on it is that I would never put him through that again.
Chemo
and the radiation. He didn't want to hear the statistics. You know, glioblastoma, stage four, multiforme.
Mm.
The survivability is, I think, like 0.2%, or it's like beyond de minimis. And make it past 2 years. I think only like something like 1% of people even make it past 2 years with severe disabilities.
And were you able to get closure all the way? I mean, were you able to?
Bo and I?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I am, I don't know how it's a, I know he's here now.
Yeah.
But he felt like he was very far away for a long time after he died.
Because of the drugs? Because of your own pain?
Yeah, my own pain. Yeah. And drugs make it even, you know, the drugs drive that feeling away, but they make the distance even further, you know?
Yeah, it seemed like he kind of got untethered from yourself.
Completely. Completely.
So Bo dies.
There was a low-level burn, which I realize is that from the very beginning, there was a, you know, what's the one thing that is obvious to everybody that is the most important thing in my dad's life? It's his family.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think they looked out there and thought, okay, where's the weak link? And, you know, and it's not, you know, I mean, D.C. is a small place.
Yeah.
It's not easy to, you know, too difficult to figure out, you know, well, you know, the attacks start then and they just kind of ramp up and they obviously become, you know, exponentially worse as my personal life just unravels.
Do you think the idea was to scare Joe out of running?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. I think that they thought that it would be a big enough distraction because, look, the essence of their attacks are literally the there's zero truth to them. But knowing that you got a son that just died
and another one
and your other son who's who's near death in many ways, and if you just keep pounding on him, like how does a guy survive that?
How does your father survive?
How does somebody survive that?
Yeah.
And
it must have been killing him. I mean, hurting his feet, breaking his heart.
Right? Oh, God. I mean, that's like what I wake up every day and just think, my God.
Yeah.
Like that guilt for putting my girls through that, you know, those days and times in which, you know,
when you were
no
fucked up,
idea what, yeah, where I was, or you know, what the hell was going on, or you know,
well, that whole, well, how many years? What that was like, four or five years.
So 2015.
Yeah,
you know, I go immediately to rehab. You know, 2 months after Bo. So
when did you first smoke the crack?
Not until that next year. So 2000. I think 16. Mm. I get it all. I really do get it in my mind. I went through when I was writing it, and I had to really, like, lay it out. I mean, I wrote it out longhand, each part, you know, part of it. Like, okay, what's the, you know, how do these all match up?
Yeah.
And then I had to have somebody else. I asked somebody else to go and, like, how do I piece together to make certain that I'm telling the right things? Because so much of it actually really bleeds together. But then, you know, a year after, basically, Bo dies, I'm in another treatment program. So that first year I went to a treatment program, spent 40 days there, got out, went back to my yoga, you know, 6 times a week and all of that. And, but then my marriage is completely unraveling.
Yeah.
And, I'm living alone for the first time in my life in separation and agreement that we made. And my brother's gone and, I'm living in that grief by myself for the first time ever.
Yeah.
And I drink again.
Yeah.
And then I get back on the horse. But, you know, I'm closest probably ever came to death with that period of drinking. I was drinking, you know, at least a quart a day. I mean, that...
Vodka.
Yeah.
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 Just by yourself.
Yeah, by myself, just sitting there. I mean, you know, I mean... Combine that with that level of grief, like you know, I felt like I lost everybody.
And, but then you're just pounding, like you're not letting yourself come up for air at all.
Don't want to, right?
Ugh.
You know? I mean, it, literally.
Yeah.
It would, the strength to be able to get out the door and walk across the street to a liquor store. I mean, I think about that today and it still gives me the chills more than anything. Yeah. And then I went to outpatient program, and then I screwed up. But they wanted me to, you know, take a drug test, and I didn't want to take the drug test because I just admitted it to them. And I said, if I take the drug test and it leaks, then it's the second time that it looks like I failed a drug test. I was actively going through a divorce. Yeah. I didn't want it to be that. And so they said, no, well, you have to take a drug test or you can't come back. And then, yeah, that was the only excuse I needed. I literally walked out the door, ran into, Rhea, who's in the book.
That whole book turns on this Rhea character, like, where... Like, all of a sudden, you know, you have this whole life with your family, with Bo and the passing of Bo, and you're putting your family through this, you know, nightmare of not knowing if you're going to be okay, and, you know, and repeating. And then you meet this woman. And I know what it's like to have a guy that can get you the shit.
Yeah.
As opposed to you going out into the world to get the shit, which you did plenty of, too. But you talk about this woman in very... respectful and reverential, and like it was a real relationship. You basically invited a houseless woman who rode around on her bicycle, high on crack, to live in your house.
Yeah,
for months.
I know, and it's by the way.
I know you know.
I mean, you got to read. I know you know. I know. You got to read it.
Yeah, of course.
To get the full.
No, but like
the context,
that's where
the
tone changed, because it's like. You know, you really get the feeling that once you hit that bottom and you live there, that's all you had. And that the immediacy of feeding the monkey, of honoring the addiction at any cost, was what you were living for.
Yeah.
And you met her and she lived the same way. And somehow or another, you had this understanding with each other.
Yeah. Well, one of the things about crack is that it's not nearly as widespread as it was when we were
kids.
But there is a thing about it that hits on every single obsessive compulsive addictive part of your being.
Yeah.
You know, it's literally fire.
Yeah.
It's, it has all of the addiction of all of the physical movements of smoking.
Yeah.
You know, like it is the oral fixation.
Yeah.
And then it has the, the fixation with the sound of the lighter going off.
Yeah.
Then you have all of your little tools and all of the little things that you need
to
do. The ritual of it. Yeah. It's got that ritual. And then it's got that big bang for its buck at the outset.
Yeah.
And all of those things. And you literally, if you you find yourself, if you're like willing to go down that rabbit hole, which I pray God nobody does listening to this, because it is awful, but it becomes everything. I mean, what it does, I spent more time crawling around on the floor in apartments, motel rooms, hotel rooms, the park, looking for little white pieces of something.
Yeah.
Then you can imagine, like hours and hours and hours, and you can just sit there as long as the supply keeps coming in and do it for hours and hours and hours. And when the supply ends, weeks.
You're talking about not
months,
sleeping for
months,
weeks.
Oh, weeks. Yeah. I mean, I would literally, I think by the end, I was there, I was maybe getting 10 hours of sleep a week at best. And you just do it and do it and do it. The only breaks would come when you'd run out, and this was after Rhea.
Yeah.
And I moved from Washington and was living basically from motel to motel. Is you run out, and the things that you will do. I mean, I had dealers that would tell me, like, I'll meet you at the 7-Eleven on X and Y at 4:30 a.m. Yeah, and I'd get there at 4:30 a.m. and you'd be the only one sitting out in the parking lot, and the guy would be looking at you through the window, and you know exactly what he was thinking. And even if it wasn't what he was thinking, you were absolutely certain that that's what he was thinking.
Right.
He was going to call a cop. And so you're sitting there, you go low in your seat, you go high in your seat, you act like it's normal, you go in to buy it, and it's 6:30, and you finally get the guy back on the phone, and he said, I'm pulling in right now. And you're in a 7-Eleven. What do you mean you're pulling in right now? I mean, it's like, it's not the Autobahn you're playing.
Well, that's the whole other relationship you talked about was with that guy, John. It's very interesting to me that the relationship with Rhea, the houseless person on the bicycle who you lived with for 5 months and watched crime shows with and smoked crack with compulsively.
Yeah.
And then you got this guy, John, who was some sort of hustler that seemed to have like a stable of crackheads. And the way you sort of try to understand your behavior, and even just hearing you talk about the ritual of smoking crack, it's like, and you said it in the book, you're like, when people don't understand why drug addicts do what they do, it's because we fucking love drugs.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Like, even when you talk about it, I'm sitting here going like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Getting a little.
Yeah, yeah, a little sweaty pumped.
But like at this point when you, you know, at this point in your life where I have to assume that like your family is sort of like, well, if he dies, he dies. There's nothing we can do.
No, God, no. It's the exact opposite. They would
really
think we're, you know, I mean, one of the things I've read about in the book is this intervention scene, which happened on, you know, on multiple mini levels.
Yeah.
Like constantly. But the, you know, the big, you know, theatrical production was when my mom calls me and I'm in one of those motels and for some reason she gets through to me and gets, you know, truly through to me and says, come down. We miss you so much.
Yeah.
Please come down and see us. And
yeah.
I come down and I walk in and there are my three daughters, my niece and nephew, my mom, my dad, and two counselors from from a rehab.
But at this point, you're like fucking taking a hit every 15 minutes.
Every 15 minutes.
You're no longer functioning. Where are you getting the money at this point?
Well, I mean, I still had some of my business, but I'm not like showing up, you know. I mean, it's running out. It's running out fast.
Okay, because like the scene you depict with, you know, these fucking, like I knew, like when I was in Hollywood at the Comedy Store in my early 20s, like living, you know, on someone else's, you know, in someone else's house and hosting these fucking coke parties, the riffraff that would come and go, they'd steal shit.
Yeah.
And you like you kind of like prided yourself on knowing this fucking, you know, weird underworld of like, for me, it was like these porno people and drug dealers and freaks. And you're like, this is life, man.
Yeah. 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 And in the moment you embrace that, that's for sure. Is that you think that you're like some kind of like, oh, you know, I like, I mean, but it's, but God, it's, you but get away from it. You're like, Jesus.
But like, I'm here with you like an hour and it's like, you're a sensitive guy. You're a sweet guy. And you allowed yourself to be a mark. I mean, you knew that they were taking you.
Oh yeah. But like, I don't know of anybody that's an addict that isn't a mark though.
No, you know I guess so. Yeah. I guess so. But like there's two sides of it, right? Either you're going to be like the guy with the gun or the guy that just says, I don't care. Take my wallet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're that guy.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
Which is probably lucky that you're not that hard.
Was, by the way, that was part of the resignation, too. You know? Like, I was like, you know? Like, I knew what I was doing was just awful, that I was killing myself. And it was like, so, you know, so somebody steals my wallet. Like, that's the least of my goddamn problems. You know? I mean.
But over and over again, it seems.
Over and over again. Over and over again. But by the way, again, like I said, if you're addicted to crack the way in which I was addicted to crack, or, you know, is it, you're an easy mark for anybody, let alone.
Because you're so fucking.
Let alone the predators that make a living out of doing that.
Right.
And you're easy. I mean, you're easily identifiable prey because you're walking up to the lion. You know what I mean? You need them. And so you put your head in their jaws and just, you know, like sometimes they bite and sometimes they don't. And sometimes they, you know, I mean, it's just absolutely the most, you know, insidious, maniacal life.
So, but like, so all this shit is going down, you know, you're being hammered as the kingpin of this grand conspiracy. The sitting president is impeached by the House trying to fucking hang you out to dry, trying to get you. Investigate. That's you and you're really the reason why he got impeached.
Yeah. And so, by the way, the book ends when I get sober.
Right.
And that's when they just start on me in earnest. And what happens is, I mean, start in on like this, Giuliani starts in on this whole Ukraine thing.
Oh, really?
So that's okay, May so that's of 2018.
Okay, well, let's just, I just want to like express my concern.
I mean, 2019,
to a degree that like, so you've committed your life to dying a crackhead, probably in a hotel room in some sad fucking way.
Yeah.
You did some strange, cracked out New Yorker interview.
By the way, probably the thing that saved my life.
Yeah.
Is because that was the first time I told anybody outside of my family. Any idea what was going on.
So was the idea there to help yourself or to help your dad?
Oh God, All I knew is that I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell my dad. I didn't tell anybody in the campaign. I didn't tell anybody except, you know, there was a part of me that's still a snob, and it was a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist from The New Yorker, and I thought, oh, that sounds like a great idea.
But he didn't know you were...
And it was like a therapy session, though. So I told him, like, the whole thing, because it was all about, well, you know, what about this and the Ukraine and that? It's like, none of that's true. But here, I'll tell you something that's true. You know? I'll tell you something that's true. This part's true. And I thought, you know what? That was my, like, fuck it. I was going to, like, tell the world, this is who I am. All this other stuff, total BS. But this is who I am.
And you were jacked.
Yeah. And for the first 75% of it, and then I meet Melissa.
See, this is here's the concern. It's sort of like, so you're, like, not even really down. You're still high. When you meet this woman.
Oh, but I was at my lowest. My lowest low.
Like you've been thrown out of another hotel.
I mean that was that was I was never thrown out. They just never had a room for me the next day.
Right. Because you go day to day, you know.
I was a valet all through college, and so I still have my valet friends who are saved my life. I don't know how many times. Just making certain that not letting that guy that was clearly coming to do something bad into the hotel room, taking my keys from me, not being able to find it. That's one thing is really important too. You know those times that you're talking about? You were saying, at the end of your, run. One thing is that I think back on it now, and because I wrote the book, it was such a useful exercise for me to also realize so many acts of kindness from virtual strangers. Of people that literally, like you ask why I didn't, why I was more of a mark instead of a, an aggressor. And is that... One of the reasons, too, number one, that's me, is that, I hate meanness. But I'll tell you what, some people that, had no reason, no gain for them, that pulled me out of a, of the way the whatever oncoming bus that it was, it just happened over and over and over again for me. And
your uncle, too.
My uncle, look, my uncle is... most amazing man, one of the most amazing people I know. He is literally there for everyone. He's my best friend in the world, and my Uncle Jim. He is an incredible human being in his own right. And so anyway, long story short though, is that when I meet Melissa, I'm talking to Adamantos with The New Yorker. And it's like a 2-hour therapy session each night. And I'm telling him my whole life story. And I get set up on a date, which I wasn't dating anybody.
You're out of your mind.
I'm out of my mind. And for some reason, I decide to call.
But it was weird because it was like some people that were at the hotel. You didn't really know.
At the hotel. I've never met her before in my life. They said, you got to meet this woman. And I said, anyway, I call and... We set up a time, and she doesn't show up, and then she doesn't show up again, and she doesn't show up again. She has no idea who I am. No idea. All they knew was me as Hunter.
But you haven't slept. You're out of your fucking mind. Didn't you ever hear voices in your head?
Oh, yeah. There's a whole scene in the book in which I think I had a, not sleeping for 16 days driving to Prescott, Arizona.
Owl?
That owl. I tell you what. It's the realest thing in my life. But
you didn't think it was Bo?
Yeah. I always think it is Bo.
Yeah. But you didn't say that in the book.
I know. I didn't want to get too California on everybody, but I absolutely felt that way. I still do. I mean, that's the other part about it, is that those little things, wow. But I walk in, and there's this incredibly beautiful South African woman from a big Jewish family in Johannesburg, and I just look, and I see something. I recognize something. I don't know whether I saw, whatever the unconditional love that my brother had for me. I knew that's what I saw. I'm not the first person who, love at first sight. But And within an hour, I tell her everything. Mm. And, you know, to her credit or not, I mean, is that she just said, that's going to end. And I don't know why, Mark. It found its way through all of that crack, all of that vodka,
yeah,
all of that grief, all of that sadness, all of that shame, all of that guilt. It found its way to, and I said, okay.
Yeah.
And now that's not the end of the story. You know what I mean? It's not that, then it took like, holy shit, what does that mean? That means that, you know, Melissa literally like, she took my keys, she took my phone, she took my clothes, she took my, you know, I mean, she had to basically play my jailer for, you know.
To get you, yeah, to detox.
Yeah, not just to detox, but then to make certain, you know, I was still, you know, like, yeah, she never left my side. She never left the apartment.
Right.
She never left the room. Mm-hmm. I mean, and she, for some reason, intuitively knew that she couldn't. And it's just, I think that anybody to do that for another human being,
yeah,
is somebody I want to be with the rest of my life.
And yeah, I never really, I didn't, like in the book, like I didn't really, like until I'm talking to you now and knowing, feeling like who you are, is like, you were just like so wide open, so broken.
So broken.
And so like, you know, you're just like you're just a throbbing sort of heart there.
Yeah.
You know, just like, so like the idea, because like my first, when I read it, I'm like, you know, this is like a junkie thing. You know, like he's getting off on this moment and he's in trouble.
Yeah.
But like, you know, when you explain it, you were just sort of like, you were finished.
Finished. And by the way, right at that moment, I knew I was finished.
Yeah.
And I saw, like, I think that's my brother too. I think it's my mom. I think it's you know, and I know it is them in terms of the, I think it's my dad, you know? I mean, when you're at the bottom of that well, you know, people always say, you know, let him hit bottom.
Yeah.
People I know who hit bottom are dead.
Yeah.
You know?
My friend used to do a bit about how, like, when you hit bottom, you'd be surprised how much give that floor has.
Yeah, exactly. It can go much lower than you think. But, you know,
yeah.
I always have said, and I really believe this,
yeah,
is that finding your way out,
yeah,
of that tunnel, you know, when there's no light on either end, without somebody coming back in for you with a lantern, is almost impossible, if not impossible. And somebody came in with the light, and I saw it, and I grabbed for it, and I haven't let go.
Why? I hope it. You know, I'm happy for you, and you know, and I hope it works out. And you got a little baby now. How old?
Baby Bo, named after my brother.
Yeah.
1 year. 1 year.
It just seems like, you know, you somehow, you know, the love got through somewhere. You found, like, you know, that...
That's the whole story.
Right. What you needed in your heart, that whatever you were doing with this pain was killing you.
Yeah.
Over and over again. And it seems like your whole family, the ones that were still with you, you know, had a lot of faith in your ability to hopefully get back to who you were.
Yeah. Yeah.
And somehow you have, you know, right now.
Yeah.
And well, it's a great story, but you know, I still am concerned, and I hope you're taking care of yourself.
No, I'm concerned. You know, I mean, I really am, in the sense of, like, I have a healthy fear.
And, you should have a healthy and unhealthy, just fear in general.
Yeah, fear. No, but I'm saying is, I'm not living in that, but it's like, you know, like, I'm leaving here, and I'm going straight home. You know what I mean? Like, I literally don't, I'm still, you know, I still am close enough and have had enough experience. So, and you know.
Do you do the Zoom meetings or?
No, I don't do Zoom meetings, but I do calls with people that I trusted in the program. I mean, every day.
That's good.
Every
day. And you talk to your old man every day?
I talk to him, yeah, every night before he goes to bed.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And your mom, everybody?
Yeah, everybody's great. My girls are great. My
they must be amazing. Relieved.
They're
tenuous.
Yeah. No. I mean, beyond relieved. I mean, it's just like, you know, I put him through so much. I mean, and I just am so incredibly grateful.
And what about, like, because I know that, you know, there was very public sort of strange grief-driven relationship with your brother's wife.
Yeah.
And are you guys all right?
Yeah, fine. I mean, I adore her. And Natalie and Hunter, my niece and nephew, are like my own. And you know.
Everybody's okay. That got weird for a while, but now you're okay.
Yeah, it did. I mean, we both, you know, that was one thing. It was like kind of all out of love.
And the grief thing is weird because grief is like you don't know what the hell it's going to do to you. I lost somebody, you know.
I know.
Almost a year ago, and
what a stupid thing to say. I'm sorry.
No, I get it. But like you don't, there's no way to judge or to understand behavior that happens in that need of sort of relief from that trauma.
You know,
and like my brother got divorced and married somebody, and their exes married each other. You know, people do. To hold on to something.
Yeah, exactly. And
it just made sense, I imagine, for a while.
It did. I thought we were bringing back.
Oh, you know what? Really? So you would summon him back? Right. Like maybe between the two of you.
Yeah.
Well, the other example, it was not really my brother, but I know a woman who used to work with a woman who went on some sort of mission, you know, a humanitarian mission in Iraq.
Yeah.
And was killed.
Yeah.
And the friend at home has like... You know, she's made a foundation. Her whole life has been in the memory of this person.
Yeah.
And she actually dated that person's boyfriend for a while because of the grief. You come together, right?
Exactly. And I was alone.
Hallie's her name?
Yeah. Yeah. But everything's good.
That's good.
No one comes in, you know, to recovery, you know, on a roll. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know that one. Yeah.
Yeah. And no. So.
Yeah. I just think, you know, because I know the one thing in the book, and like, look, I'm no bleeding deacon.
Yeah.
but, you know, and my program is whatever it is, but I do know that in the first 5 years of my sobriety, I was every day with the meeting, put sobriety first before anything else.
Yep.
You know, nothing, you know, and I hammered that shit in my head every fucking day.
Yep.
And
by the way, so do I.
Okay.
100%.
Okay.
I am literally, I have a discussion with somebody in the program every single day, mostly three times a day. Yep. Got a sponsor.
So when are you going to do that fourth?
What? Yeah. Well, you know what?
The book.
Part of it was the book.
Yeah.
And, you know, and maybe a little bit right here, but I don't care what anybody says about the program. It saved me.
Sure.
And it keeps saving me. And all I know is at the end of it is one thing, is that whole, you know, the promises and.
Yeah. The obsession will be lifted.
Yeah,
that's the big one.
Yeah. Which allows you to be of service to other people.
Oof,
and hopefully that is what the book does. I mean, it gives me an opportunity. You know,
made me nervous for you, but I'm glad that it's okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
You know what I mean?
Thank you.
As somebody who, because like the one thing I noticed was that like when you start talking about Rhea and when the crack comes in, once you get through the death, it's sort of like the amount of focus to the ritual of smoking crack to the choy boy and the hard and all the lingo. I was like, oh boy.
Yeah.
He loves his shit.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you're doing what you have to do, and it sounds like you got, you know, a beautiful thing going on, and your family feels better, and your dad's president, and you can feel like you're not dragging him a bit. You know, he's got a lot on his plate.
Yeah.
Now but are you still in a little bit of trouble?
Oh, no. I mean, there's an investigation. I think everything's going to be fine.
Yeah?
Yeah. But it's, you know, I let it play itself out. But I'm absolutely certain at the end of the day, everything's going to be fine.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm absolutely, I did nothing wrong. And so.
What is it, taxes?
Taxes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I have really good accountants.
It's like, it's tricky, man. It must be, does the weight of that kind of like after everything that's gone on, in terms of, you know, your name being dragged and you being used as this portal to try to damage your dad, that, like, you know, like, it seems to me it's one of those situations that, you know, it's a difficult on either side. If you do get off, they're going to be like, oh, he got off because of his old man.
Yeah.
And then if you don't get off, it's going to be the most painful thing in the world for everybody involved.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I just know that, you know, I'm cooperating with anything anybody wants to ask me. I'm an absolute open book, complete transparency. It's good. All out there.
All
and
right.
what, you know, and whatever it, whatever comes, I know that there are people that are, you know, professionals, and this is what they do. And
yeah.
and it's going to come to a conclusion. I know what I've done, and I know that I've done nothing wrong. And
okay.
so I'm going to let the process play out. Yeah. But I'm going to be okay.
Okay, buddy. I gotta believe
you. Know what? I do appreciate. I mean it for real.
Yeah.
I appreciate the concern. people listening can't see this, but your eyes. I see it in your eyes too. I'm okay, buddy. I really do.
All right,
I appreciate
man. It. Well, good luck with the book, and take care of yourself.
For real, it's an honor.
Thanks, man.
You know, one of the things since I've been is I listen to you twice a week.
Oh yeah, good.
Yeah, you kept me tethered.
The thing. Yeah,
yeah.
Well, I'll give you my number. You can anytime
Absolutely.
You need to call.
I appreciate it.
Okay, man.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. Yes, that was Hunter Biden. Try to stay in touch with him around the sobriety thing. I feel like that he's a pretty tender-hearted guy beneath all this. He's definitely not a sociopath or a bad dude. And I believe he knows he still has got a long road ahead of him. And I wish him well, and I'll help how I can. Do what you can, folks. Hang in there. How about a little guitar? How about it? Cat angels everywhere. Sammy the sidestepper. Buster the bully. All accounted for.